From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The great musical Guys and Dolls opened on Broadway 50 years ago today. On today's archive edition, we celebrate by listening to music by the show's composer, Frank Lesser, and discussing his life and work with his daughter, Susan Lesser. Also, we hear from Teller, the magician who is usually the silent half of the duo Penn and Teller. His new book is a portrait of his father, called When I'm Dead, All This Will Be Yours. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews pianist Uri Caine's new CD, The Goldberg Variations, and Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the hip-hop group Outkast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Even though Florida's Secretary of State is expected to certify the state's presidential results on Sunday, the drama is expected to stretch well into next week. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear arguments from the two presidential campaigns next Friday. Lawyers for the Bush and Gore campaigns will argue whether Florida's highest court was right in ordering that hand-recounted ballots must be counted in the state's final presidential vote tally. Florida's Republican-controlled legislature said today that it will seek to join in that suit. Beyond that, Florida law says the losing side can contest an election within 10 days after certification. Election officials in West Palm Beach held a hearing today on Democratic arguments that dimpled ballots should be included in their final presidential tally. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from West Palm Beach.
The hearing revolved around the Palm Beach Canvassing Board's practice of not counting dimpled votes for president unless there were dimpled votes in other columns on the same ballot. This policy has resulted in as many as 10,000 uncounted ballots that have been set aside by the county. This morning, Democrats argued that the accepted standard is to count dimpled chads regardless of what is present on the rest of the ballot. Republicans urged the three-person board to stick to its stricter standard and not follow the example of Broward County, which liberalized its counting policies to be more inclusive of dimpled ballots. But the chairman of the canvassing board, Judge Charles Burton, appeared to be leaning toward the Democratic interpretation of the law, saying his study of case law favored including ballots where the board can reasonably assess the voter's intent. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, West Palm Beach.
Republican vice presidential candidate Dick Cheney has been released from the hospital after he checked himself in early Wednesday morning with mild chest pain. Doctors found that he had suffered a slight heart attack and did surgery to prop open a blocked artery. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Former Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says he's under doctor's orders to rest this weekend, but he plans to resume a close-to-normal schedule next week. He says he's plenty healthy to take on the job of vice president, although doctors will be reviewing his eating and exercise habits.
It's a reminder of the importance of living a healthy lifestyle and doing all of those things that a prudent man would do, given the fact that I have a long history of coronary artery disease. But in terms of work, the kinds of activities I can engage in professionally, there are no restrictions.
Cheney said he doubts the stress from the recount and lawsuits in Florida played a role in his heart attack. He called running the Pentagon during the 1991 Gulf War the ultimate stress. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 71 points to close at 10,470 in light trading. The Nasdaq gained 149 points, or 5.4%, to close at 2903. This is NPR News. Daimler Chrysler says mounting financial losses may force the automaker to cut jobs, idle some plants, and possibly renegotiate its union contracts. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
The German-American car company had already planned to temporarily close three production plants next week after reporting more than $500 million in losses during the past quarter. Company officials in Berlin say that lost revenue could force white-collar layoffs at Chrysler. The automaker may also try to redo its current contract with the United Auto Workers Union, which runs through the year 2003 and calls for the company to pay 95% of a laid-off employee's typical wages. But changing that deal could call into question similar agreements that the UAW has reached with Ford and General Motors. Still, Daimler Chrysler shows no signs of slowing its recent massive restructuring effort, which has included replacing most of Chrysler's top executives with former members of the automaker's Mercedes-Benz division. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Israeli officials say Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat have agreed to resume low-level security contacts. The two leaders spoke briefly by telephone today as Arafat was meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. The Israelis say the leaders agreed to reopen security liaison offices that were closed by Israel yesterday after an Israeli officer in one of the offices was killed by mortar fire. The offices were set up during the peace process to provide a place where Israeli and Palestinian police could work out problems. Violence continued today in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Warner Brothers Records, presenting Pat Metheny Trio live. Information available on the web, patmethenygroup.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The great musical Guys and Dolls opened on Broadway 50 years ago today. It was based on a Damon Runyon story about gamblers and showgirls. In commemoration, the Museum of the City of New York is presenting an exhibition of photos and archival material reflecting the subject and era of the show. Guys and Dolls was filled with great songs, such as If I Were a Bell, I've Never Been in Love Before, and Luck Be a Lady. The songs were all written by Frank Lesser, who also wrote the songs for the musicals How to Succeed and The Most Happy Fella. Early in his career, he worked as a lyricist in Hollywood, where he was matched with Hoagy Carmichael. They co-wrote Heart and Soul and Two Sleepy People. Lesser was soon writing words and music for movies. We're going to hear an interview with his oldest child, Susan Lesser. She was born during his first marriage when he was living in Hollywood. Let's start with the title song from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls, which was recently reissued.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal. Call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some dough. When you see a Joe saving half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some dough. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, it's a cinch that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum fal de ral, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12 to 7 that the guy's only doing it for some doll.
I spoke to Susan Lesser in 1993 after the publication of her memoir about her father. I love some of the stories of Frank Lesser working with singers. Tell us a little bit about the audition for Guys and Dolls and what he had the singers do as they auditioned.
Oh, he had them yell for help. And they wouldn't understand what he meant. And he'd say, yell help, that's what I mean. He wanted to hear how loud they were. His motto was loud is good. He wanted the audience to hear every word and every note from every seat in the house. And he wanted no embellishments. He wanted his music sung note for note and loud.
In the movie version of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra played the role of Nathan Detroit. And your father, the composer Frank Lesser, did not like what Sinatra was doing with Lesser's songs.
No, he didn't.
Why didn't he like it?
Well, Nathan Detroit is a very rough character, a Broadway character, and the original Nathan, Sam Levine, couldn't sing. He only had one song, Sue Me, and he came in wrong all the time on the first note, so my father had to write him a four-bar phrase, call a lawyer, and if you listen to it, I will not sing it. It slides up to the correct note to come in on. That was how bad Sam sang, but he was also brilliant and wonderful and rough and tough and Runyon-esque, whereas Frank Sinatra was very smooth and crooned his songs. And in fact, Goldwyn had my father write three more songs for Nathan in the movie, for Frank Sinatra. And my father would listen to Sinatra rehearse and would become angrier and angrier. And finally, they had it out, and my father kind of met his match with Frank Sinatra, who exploded about the same way my father did, both of them screaming words that I won't say on the radio. As it ended, Frank Sinatra, of course, performed the songs his way, and they never spoke again.
Did your father sing around the house a lot?
He sang when he was working on something. More often, he played the piano, mm-hmm. working on songs. But yes, he sang too, and he and my mother worked out songs together. There are some wonderful old recordings of them singing "Baby, It's Cold Outside" and "Make a Miracle" from "Where's Charlie."
Yeah, it's interesting. You write about how "Baby, It's Cold Outside" used to be your parents' song, and they would sing
yes.
it at parties together until it was actually used in a film.
Right. They and my mother adored that, because they would go to parties, and after the first time they sang the song, they were in great demand because it was such a wonderful, fun song, and they had such a good time singing it together, and they were very good performers of it. And so my mother felt it was her claim to fame at that time to perform this song at parties. And when he sold it to MGM for a movie called Neptune's Daughter with Esther Williams and Ricardo Montalban, it broke my mother's heart. She was very upset about losing the song. But then it won an Academy Award, so it made up for it.
After hearing your father sing on that Evening With album,
mm-hmm.
I assumed he was from an immigrant family of Jews in New York, probably Brooklyn, maybe Manhattan, probably the first in his family to finish school. And after reading your book, I found out this was not his background at all. Yeah, tell us what his background really was.
My father's father was a music teacher, a Prussian, who was very fearsome. My father came from a family of intellectuals, musicologists, and people who felt that the route that my father chose to go was very low class and very unappealing. They were amused by him, and they didn't think much of him most of his life.
Your life must have really changed dramatically when you were 12 and 13. That's when you moved to New York from Hollywood.
Yes.
Your father's show, Most Happy Fellow, opened on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and it was during that show that he fell in love with his second wife, Joe Sullivan,
right,
and left your mother. And your mother was actually involved in introducing Joe Sullivan to Frank Lesser.
My mother did a lot of the casting for The Most Happy Fellow. She was co-producer with Kermit Bloomgarden. And when she heard Joe sing, she said, boy, this is a voice. This is a voice and a personality Frank would just love. So she sent Joe to audition for my father, sealing her fate. It was a very hard time for everybody. My brother and I were uprooted from our California suburban lifestyle and brought to New York City. We had visited but never lived here. I went to a new school. I was living with my mother. We were both, my brother and I, living with our mother and nurse in an apartment situation. We at first stayed with friends and then moved to a small apartment. My mother was not happy and was drinking more and more, and I had never lived in such close quarters with her before, and that was when I began to see that she had big problems. Everything changed for all of us. My father was living across Central Park in an apartment of his own and having his affair with Joe, and everybody was, he wasn't real happy either. It was a time full of turmoil. Although for him, I think it was mitigated a great deal by the great success of The Most Happy Fella. I think, you know, for him that show was so important. He wrote not only the music and the lyrics, but he wrote the book, and he was involved day to day with every aspect of it, to Joe Anthony, the director's great consternation. My father attempted to direct it as well.
Well, you write that when your father left your mother, when your mother was 40, that your mother lost her man, her lifestyle, and her status.
Mm-hmm.
Did she ever recover from that?
No, she never did. She never did. She used to say that my father fired her because she had worked for him for so long. And that was all very funny and clever, but she never recovered. She never was reemployed by anyone. She tried to make it on her own as a producer. She had flop after flop. And eventually, she had terrible health problems, which were exacerbated by her drinking. And she died lonely and alone. It was a very sad life. She rejected the friends who didn't reject her in the beginning, the people who stayed with her. She one by one rejected them, threw them away, and was a very lonely, bitter person.
When you were growing up and still living in the same house with your father, did you ever eavesdrop on him while he was writing a song?
Well, I didn't really have to eavesdrop. He had a little organ in his room, and I would stop there on my way down to breakfast because he was a very early riser, and he would already be deep at work. But I didn't see it as work. I didn't know what he was doing. He would be playing a phrase over and over again on the organ, and then he would get up and pace for a while, and then he'd sit in his chair and smoke 7 or 8 cigarettes and drink some more coffee and get up and play some more music. And I'd say, "What are you doing?" And he'd say, "I'm working."
Right.
And, you know, that was another one of those surreal mysteries to me.
Is there any song that you feel particularly a part of because you were either with him while he was writing it, or you heard it ringing through the house, or he told you about it? Or
I think the song of his that means the most to me is a very small, short song in Guys and Dolls, and it's called My Time of Day. And it's a poem, it's an ode to New York at 4 in the morning when the street lamps light the gutter with gold. It was a song that Sky Masterson sings to Sarah Brown, and it really characterizes my father, I think. I think that he liked that song the best in that show, and to me, that song is my father.
Well, Susan Lesser, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for talking with us.
My time of day is the dark time. A couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with the mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and the street lamp light fills a gutter with gold, that's my time of day. And you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me. Obadiah.
Obadiah, what's that?
Obadiah Masterson, that's my real name. You're the first person I ever told it to.
Susan Lesser's memoir about her father was published in paperback this year. We spoke in 1993. Coming up, discovering Frank Lesser's demo recordings. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When Frank Lesser wrote his shows, he made demo recordings to demonstrate to the cast what the songs sound like. Those demos were discovered years later by Joseph Weiss, the copyright manager of Paul McCartney's publishing company, which acquired Lesser's publishing company in 1979. Along with the acquisition came hundreds of unindexed tapes. Weiss listened to those tapes and discovered, to his delight, that some of them featured Lesser himself. In 1992, Weiss produced a CD of the demos, and I spoke to him about the recordings. Lesser is the first voice you'll hear on this trio version of Fugue for Tin Horns, which he wrote for Guys and Dolls.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and he's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
Are you crazy? I'm picking Valentine, 'cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But look at Epitaphy, where's it by a half? According to this here and on telegraph, I tell you, Epitaph.
Valentine,
I got the horse. Right here.
Who's the finest old Valentine? Besides the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
Not just a minute, boys. I got the beatbox noise. It says the great grandfather was equipoise.
For Paul Revere, I'll fight. I hear his foot's all right. Of course,
this guy says the horse shows
right last night.
I tell you, Epitaph.
Paul Revere,
I got the horse. Right here.
Tell me what the experience was like the first time you found one of these Frank Lesser demo recordings and you put it on and heard it.
It's a very hard thing to explain. Not only because of how great the recordings themselves are, but because of how I feel about Frank Lesser. It was a very exciting experience, and it was immediately satisfying. The first time that I heard his voice, I wasn't even sure it was his voice. It was a guess because it was one of his songs. I honestly don't remember now which one it was. But it was clearly not a commercial singer, and it was just that interesting voice with a piano. There are, I'd say, five geniuses in musical theater whose names always come up when we talk about the creation of American musical theater. And they are George Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Irving Berlin, and Cole Porter. And I always feel that there should be a sixth name in there, that Frank Lesser's name belongs in that group. And there are a few reasons it probably doesn't show up there. One of them is that his output for Broadway was only 5 scores, and it only spanned 15 years. And that he's actually a later writer than the rest of them. He wasn't there for the formative years, which all of the others were. And he also wasn't excessively self-promoting, which is not to say the others were, but that had he chosen to do so, I think his name could have become a household word just like the others.
Well, one of just the revelations of this record is listening to Frank Lesser sing Sue Me from Guys and Dolls, and this is a different version of it than you'd hear on any of the cast recordings or in any of the shows. Do you want to describe what's different about it?
Yes. Well, two things are different. One is that it's not a duet, which is the way the song is done in the show. And it also has a verse which isn't used in the show. And it's a very sweet, low-key, subtle, as far as the comedy is concerned, version of the song. It's not only done this way on this demonstration recording. It was actually published this way at the time Guys and Dolls opened on Broadway. And there were recordings by other artists in this style.
Now, in the original cast recording, Sam Levine sang the part, or played the part, I should say, yeah, of Nathan Detroit. That's the same part that was played by Frank Sinatra in the movie. And Sam Levine couldn't sing, so he just kind of, like, brays this song. You know, he just kind of hollers the song, whereas Frank Lesser sings it as a lovely ballad with really kind of funny lyrics.
Yes.
Why don't we hear Frank Lesser singing Sue Me?
So you're all the time right, and I'm all the time wrong. So my character's weak, and your character's strong.
So your brow is so high and my brow is so low. Well, brow, schmow, I'm close to you now. And all I can tell you is, oh, go sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me. I love you. All right already, I'm just a no good Nick. All right already, it's true. So new, so sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you.
You got these Frank Lesser demonstration discs just in a kind of bundle, I guess. How come do you think they weren't taken better care of?
Well, I think the reason they weren't taken better care of is that, to a large extent, I don't think the people who were handling the catalog for several years realized that that's what was there. The way discs and tapes of this kind are often marked would be as simple as a label that says, Luck Be a Lady. And there would be hundreds of discs marked Luck Be a Lady in a catalog like that, and most of the time they'd identify the artist. On a demonstration disc, the artist is rarely identified, whether it's a commercial singer or the original composer. So I don't think that anyone neglected material because they didn't care, but just because it wasn't obvious that it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that made it such a pleasure to play through the material, was that if I picked up a disc that said Luck Be a Lady and dropped the needle on it, I didn't know if I was going to hear just another reference dub of the cast album or if the voice that came over the speakers was going to be the genius who wrote the song.
What a thrill this all must have been.
It was. It was. The period, it was about 10 years ago that all of this took place, that my playing through the recordings took place. And I was fairly new to the music business at the time. And it was an incredible experience for me. It was, now it occurs as a very sweet, romantic period for me to be new to the business and yet have the privilege of listening, and listening alone in the, you know, the late hours of the day, to material that probably hadn't been heard by anyone for decades.
Joseph Weiss recorded in 1992, the year he produced a CD of Frank Lesser demo recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, the people all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat. The people all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking the boat. I sailed away on that little...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Teller, the magician who's the silent member of the duo Penn and Teller. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews pianist Uri Kane's new CD, The Goldberg Variations. That's Kane at the piano now. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the hip-hop group Outkast.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. J.S. Bach's Goldberg Variations of 1742 is a set of 30 variations for solo keyboard. It's based on the aria we're listening to. This version is played by Uri Kane. Kane is best known as a jazz pianist, but in recent years he's recorded and performed the music of Gustav Mahler, freely resetting Mahler's melodies for small band and incorporating elements of jazz and Jewish liturgical music. Kane followed his Mahler with projects devoted to the music of Wagner and Schumann. Now comes his 2-CD Goldberg Variations. Critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
For Uri Kane, Bach's Goldberg Variations sum up what the composer had learned over a lifetime. The Goldbergs reflected a variety of styles and strategies, and Kane's version follows suit. He was also inspired by Glenn Gould's 1955 recording and how his radical take could make folks hear Bach with fresh ears. As composer or pianist, Uri Kane has a solid grounding in classical music, and his Goldberg Variations includes a few in-jokes for Bachophiles and affectionate parodies of Berg, Mozart, and Rachmaninoff. Many of Kane's settings employ ancient instruments to put the sound of Bach's time in your ear. At best, the music has a double consciousness, as 1742 and 1999 overlap. The effect can be like spotting a cell phone in a Vermeer painting. Kane restages most of Bach's 30 variations, one way or another, interspersed with some 40 new ones. He draws on a diverse cast of jazz and classical musicians, singers, poets, DJs, a choir, and two string quartets. One way Kane unifies the program is to keep bringing back key soloists, including reed players Don Byron and Greg Osby, trumpeter Ralph Alessi, and singer David Moss. Bach has been updated before by jazz combos, Moog synthesizer players, and rock organists showing off their education. Those are all baby steps next to this. Uri Kane's own variations are informed by the Goldbergs' chords and general architecture, and by aspects of Bach's method. Bach wrote religious music and used the dance steps of his time. Cane taps gospel singer Barbara Walker. Also, Colombian salsa and merengue singer Marco Bermudez, as Cane uses Latin rhythms as a recurring motif. He also plays with the associations listeners may bring to a style. When Bach composed the Goldbergs in his late 50s, his improvisational and contrapuntal music had begun to seem old-fashioned. In a single piece, Cane can hint at Bach's archaic quality and look ahead to a future music that would revive his beloved improvisation and counterpoint. Some of Cane's variations lead him far afield, but that's okay. Writing the Goldbergs, Bach deviated from his plan once or twice, with the same intent, to open the music out and let it breathe. Uri Cane plays all the keyboard parts here, which doesn't get overbearing, because he doesn't play all the time, and because of his wide practical experience as a working New York musician. For Uri Cane, as for J.S. Bach, the Goldberg Variations is a sort of musical autobiography, a portrait of what he's learned on the job as an improviser who composes. It's hard to think of any recent project with comparable sweep, grandeur, and humor. I can't think of anything quite like it, or anyone else who could pull it off, or even think it up.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is based in Chicago. He reviewed Uri Cane's new CD, The Goldberg Variations, on the Winter and Winter label. Coming up, Teller, the magician of the duo Penn and Teller. This is Fresh Air. Nothing is more lame than a bad magic act, and no two people know that better than the magic and comedy duo Penn and Teller. They won't even call their act magic. Tricks, cons, and swindles are more like it, pretty amazing ones. My guest Teller has stayed locked in a water tank for longer than Houdini. David Letterman called Penn and Teller evil geniuses. After he told them to trick him, and they responded by magically releasing dozens of live cockroaches onto the set. Now Teller has a new book that isn't about magic. It's about his father. It's called When I'm Dead, All This Will Be Yours. It's about his father's adventures before Teller was born, when he was a hobo and artist. The book includes his father's drawings, paintings, and journal entries.
Penn and Teller are a study in contrasts. Penn is large and loud. Teller is shorter and never speaks on stage. In fact, for years he didn't speak to the press. When I spoke with him in 1997, I asked him why he was speaking.
Over the years, we've grown to trust our audience more. It used to be that when I was in the lobby, I would stay silent after the show. And then it gradually dawned on us that the entire audience knows perfectly well that I can talk. And it was kind of a sign of respect to when they said, "And we enjoyed your show," to say, "Thank you." And that's been extending over the years, and to the point where I've done print interviews for a long time. And then I started to do little pieces on NPR on All Things Considered. Now here I am with you.
How did you start not talking in your performances?
The first I remember not talking was when I was actually about maybe 10 or 11 and going out for Halloween. And I discovered that if I didn't talk, people never recognized me in my Halloween costume. They always recognized my voice, which was very distinctive to them. You know, I mean, what is 10 people on the same street? Of course, they're going to recognize my voice. And then, as I began to work more in theater and magic, I became really interested in plot, and I started to pay attention to what magicians usually said. And what they usually said was things like, "Here I have a red ball. Now I'm placing it into my left hand. And now, lo, it is gone." All stuff that the audience could see for itself. So it became obvious to me that there ought to be a level of any piece of performance, especially any piece of magical performance, that people can perceive by watching it. So I thought this was a kind of interesting challenge because nobody was doing it at the time at all. And I began to work on this with a college drama professor of mine. I went to Amherst College, and we worked on several pieces that were silent. I then tried the silent stuff at the fraternity parties and found miraculously that if I had gone in and started to try to shout down the crowd,
yeah,
you know, I would have been heckled to death. Go in, don't say a damn thing, shine spotlight, little spotlights on you, turn off all the other lights in the room. And lo and behold, the frat boys would momentarily remove their hands from their girlfriends' breasts, set down their cups of beer, and pay attention.
Now, since you didn't speak in your performances, since you don't speak in your performances, were you ever afraid you'd be confused with a mime?
Well, mimes generally don't use props, and mimes generally have their faces painted white and behave much like a piece of sugar candy. And I don't think anybody's apt to confuse me with that because, among other things, I'm very unconscious of exterior manifestations of what I'm thinking. That is, I don't think about making faces. I don't think about holding positions. And mime is sort of more akin to dance in that, you know, where people do think about their postures and the shapes they're making. I just think about the evil thoughts I'm thinking. and that's how I work.
You have evil thoughts in your head when you're performing?
Oh, very often, yes.
Like what?
Well, in the show, you know, one of the things that I've done for the longest time is to slash a rose to bits by cutting its shadow apart. There's a sort of a white paper screen and a rose in front of it and a little lamp, and the lamp casts the shadow of the rose on the screen, and wherever I slash through the paper of the screen, the corresponding portion of the rose withers and dies. There are very evil thoughts that go through your head when you're doing that. The punchline to that, which I'm very proud of, because not that many pieces of magic have a good twist at the end, is that I accidentally prick my finger with the knife. And when I'm holding my hand out to look at the wound, the shadow bleeds. There's lots of evil thoughts around that.
Now, tell me more about why you got into this kind of malevolent side of magic, thinking evil thoughts with magic. Because magic, for a lot of people, is just this kind of pure delight and, you know, very kind of joyful and...
insipid.
Yes, right. Yes.
Joyful and insipid or fraudulently mystical. I like drama. I like drama. It's very simple. And I always have. The things that have attracted me have never been frivolous sorts of comedies. You know, my favorite movie is Psycho. My favorite play is Oedipus Rex. My favorite Shakespearean play is Macbeth. My favorite short story writer is Poe. That's just me. I don't know that I pulled magic in that direction so much as I was pulled in that direction by those desires. And I've found a curious thing, which is that the darker the thought that I'm thinking, the funnier the audience finds it.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of the Curse of Cassandra. I think Apollo came down and offered to make love to Cassandra, the Greek maiden. She turned him down, and he cursed her. And the curse was she would always make correct prophecies, and no one would ever believe her. And that's kind of the way I feel when I'm thinking the darkest of thoughts, and the audience is laughing its head off, and I'm happy, though.
On your TV show, Home Invasion, one of the things you do is you get into the water tank. This is something you've done on stage, but in this show, you're doing it in a family's living room. And do the setup for us. Describe what's happening in this.
Well, we have sent a family out of their house. We've gotten their consent to be on a television show. They don't know anything about what we're going to do. So we sent them out of their house and set up our lights and set up our water tank, which is a thing that looks like a phone booth full of water, in their living room. And it's an unpleasant-looking thing because I am inside the water tank, and I am locked in there with bars keeping me from getting my face to the surface of the water. We then draped this entire thing with a piece of fabric, so they just saw this red monolith in their living room, brought them back in, and sat them down. And Penn announced that he was going to do a little bit of close-up magic, something very un-Penn and Tellery, just a piece of close-up magic. But to keep the home audience interested, at which point he whips away the sheet, revealing me in the water tank, Teller, he says, will hold his breath until Penn finds the correct selected card. Now, this is something we do on stage, and it's pretty effective. But putting it in somebody's living room and having them suddenly find a couple of hundred gallons of water in a large tank in the middle of their living room with a man holding his breath in a life-and-death situation is quite another
thing. While a card trick is being done.
And also in the theater, you know, there's something about the frame of a theater that makes you know that everything's going to come out just fine in the end. Well, when it's happening in your living room where real things happen, it has quite a different feel. And as the plot unfolds, Penn fails to find the card, but I insist on remaining in the water tank. And Penn acknowledges my heroic insistence to remain in the water tank and then ignores me while I completely drown. And the thing ends up with Penn shrugging and basically telling the people that from now on it's a pretty easy trick as this corpse is floating there in their living room and leaving them in their living room with it's 4 or 5 people with a large tank of water and Teller's corpse. And the final moments of the show are just very pleasant in watching these people trying to deal with the fact that they now have a corpse in their living room.
Which makes the trick even better because, of course, you're not dead, which means that you are under that water even longer than we could have ever imagined you'd be able to survive there. You've been under so long that you're forced to play dead to be credible.
It's exceedingly unpleasant to do.
I was going to ask you that, especially, I should point out, you're wearing a suit and tie, your standard, you know, theatrical garb, in that water tank. So in addition to what you must be going through with air, you know, you're wearing a suit and tie in there.
The suit and tie doesn't bother
me
very much. Nothing compared with the strain on my lungs.
Tell me what it feels like. I have no clue how you make this trick work.
Mm.
But whatever it is, I'm sure it's not pleasant.
No, it's not. If it were only the claustrophobia of being in that confinement,
it would just be like an MRI.
yeah, it would. That would still be pretty unpleasant.
Yeah.
But I'm used to it now. You know, I've done that thing for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And I've grown comfortable with it, and all the physical things that I need to have good and strong and workable are very comfortable and workable now. When I first tried it, it was very strenuous. The first time we ever did it was on national television on Saturday Night Live, and there were serious problems that very first performance. And if you should ever see it in rebroadcast on TV, they do close-ups of my face, and my eyes look very full of anxiety, and they are very full of anxiety. Now, not actually full of anxiety over death. They're full of anxiety over embarrassment, because we never do anything that would actually risk my death or Penn's death. It's extremely important if you're going to do dangerous things to always have several levels of safety precaution on them. And in that particular one, on Saturday Night Live, there was a particular gesture that if I made this gesture, one of our assistants would run out, unlock the tank, and drag out my waterlogged body. Before I had a chance to drown.
You just tell me one thing about the water tank. How much of that really depends on you holding your breath for a long time or breathing in a most minimal way?
You're asking questions about how we're doing the trick? Is that what you're asking?
Do I get punished by the Magicians Union
no,
for this?
No, you don't. You just get reminded that a good piece of the pleasure in watching one of these things is wondering how real it is. You know, that's really an interesting feature about watching a magical performance. It isn't just wondering how it's done. It's wondering where reality leaves off and trick begins.
So anyways, we're just going to let me wonder about
yes,
where that line is.
We're going to let you wonder, but not without saying that magic seems to have a very useful function in society. And that useful function consists in making people realize that even when people are lying straight in their faces and saying, I am lying, that they can still be fooled. And that means that when they turn on their TV the next time and someone lies straight in their faces, someone dressed usually exactly like Penn and Teller in gray business suits, they view it with a little more skepticism. And that's a very salutary effect.
Teller of the duo Penn and Teller, recorded in 1997. Teller has a new book about his father called When I'm Dead, All This Will Be Yours. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD from the hip-hop group Outkast. This is Fresh Air. Outkast is an Atlanta-based hip-hop group led by Andre Benjamin and Antoine Patton, who goes by the name Big Boy. Their fourth CD was just released. It's called Stanconia, and rock critic Ken Tucker says its ambition and accessibility should expand Outkast's audience.
Funny and frank, Outkast's Stanconia extends and transcends the southern funk rock hip-hop synthesis that this Atlanta duo nurtured so fruitfully on their previous release, 1988's Aquamini. Andre Benjamin and Antoine Big Boy Patton may be intent on proving they are, as they say at one point on this 17-cut epic, the coolest motherfunkers on this planet, but these guys are nothing if not down to earth. Their influences include, most crucially, the comedian Richard Pryor, as well as funk guru George Clinton. Like both of those artists, Benjamin and Patton love puns and wordplay. Their CD's references to the underground smell road and nursery rhyme chants of I stank I can, I stank I can, emphasize the blues definition of funky as smelly, that is to say, low down, blunt, pungent, a measure of authenticity.
Regular draws and
and I will call for your call.
Out the blue, I hope that you do too. I'll call before.
Benjamin and Patton shift with dizzyingly assured fluidity between the real and the surreal. A cut such as Ms. Jackson is a beautifully detailed, sung-spoken apology to the grandmother of the narrator's baby, in which he laments his breakup with the child's mother and promises to uphold his responsibility as a parent.
I'm sorry, Ms. Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times. I'm sorry, Ms. Jackson.
Like me. She be doing things like having the boys come from her neighborhood to the studio trying to fight me. She need to get a piece of American pie and take her bite out. That's my house. I disconnect the cable and turn the lights out. And let her know her grandchild is a baby and not a paycheck. Private school, daycare, it's medical bills, I pay that. I love your mom and everything. See, I ain't the only one who lay down. She want to rip you up and start a custody war. My lawyer, stay down. She never got a chance to hear my side of the story. We was divided. She had fish fries and cookouts for my child's birthday. I ain't invited. Despite it, I show her the utmost respect when I fall through. All you, you will defend that lady when I call you.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am.
At the other sonic extreme is the more militant song Explosion, which exhorts black performers to avoid being, quote, brainwashed to be commercial clowns. The song is a powerful distillation of the message that Spike Lee is delivering in his current movie Bamboozled. Similarly, the CD's first single, B.O.B., that stands for Bombs Over Baghdad, is a frenetically shouted tour de force featuring drum beats that spray across the melody like a round of gunfire. In the whirling universe of Stankonia, Teddy Pendergrass, the old sitcom Three's Company, and Anne Frank all get name-checked to good effect. And to all the commentators who've lauded Eminem for his use of internal rhyme, Outkast offers the white homophobe a superior example of such poetic rhetoric. Quote, "Speech only reaches those who know about it. This is how we go about it." All this while demonstrating that the way they go about it is to be endlessly good-humored and imaginative, even when dealing with the most grim and mind-deadening facets of ghetto life. Stankonia reeks of artful ambition rendered with impeccable skill, or as their song title so concisely has it, so fresh, so clean. Take a deep breath and jump into this music.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
We just can't be amazed. Even if you pull the pin from your hand grenade, we just can't be amazed. Even if you pull the pin from your hand grenade, we just can't be amazed. Even if you pull the pin from your hand grenade.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause, by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a voice lesson from voice and acting coach Patsy Rodenberg. She's trained some of the world's leading actors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.